Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, my name is Rainer Hirsch. I am a conductor and comedian, and welcome to my proms in the pub. Now, that's not the proms as in the end-of-year dance in which high school seniors dress up in formal attire and fret about who to go with, but a summer music festival. Some would say the world's greatest summer music festival. 8 weeks of music making centred on the Royal Albert Hall in London and featuring some of the world's greatest orchestras and soloists. Since 1927, the Proms has been run by the BBC, that's the British Broadcasting Corporation, which I am at pains to point out, I am nothing to do with, although both I and my producer, Julian Mayers, have worked extensively for the Beeb in the past. Every single concert in the season can be heard live on the BBC and for 30 days on demand thereafter through their Sounds app. And it goes without saying, we encourage you to do just that. Alternatively, make your actual way to the actual Albert Hall and attend in person, which you can do for as little as £6 as a promenader, i.e. standing. £6. What's £6? You could lose £6 and not notice. But the BBC is the thing. Everything to do with the Proms has always come through the Beeb, with its packed schedule and mission statements. In this podcast, we're taking time unofficially to chat about things Proms without going through the prism of Auntie. That's the BBC as it's known affectionately in the UK. If you like, it's the unvarnished enthusiast's view with, we hope, some good laughs thrown in. Twice a week for the duration of the festival, we'll be talking to everyone from performers, past and present, agents, critics, members of the audience, the lot. We're only going to be making episodes for the period of the Proms, that's this year from the 15th of July to the 10th of September, which is summer in the UK and therefore rains slightly more. Accordingly, we promise that each episode will end up in that other great British institution, the pub, for some final reflections and, on occasion, a bit of a musical treat. To make sure you don't miss a thing, please, 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 please subscribe and send any feedback to rainer@promsinthepub.co.uk. You can also check out our website, www.promsinthepub.co.uk. And so, to episode the first. I'm delighted to welcome as our very first guest a soloist who's been described as the very queen of the Proms, virtuoso violinist Tasmin Little. Tasmin has a wealth of stories about what it's actually like to appear at the Albert Hall and casts a weather eye over some of the performers in this year's festival. I met her at a house in sunny West London, and this is what happened.
Thank you so much for doing so. I'm sitting feeling like I'm being interviewed, but actually, forgive me for looking so casual. But it's so nice to be here
Thank you.
To have your time. And I know that you've appeared 20 times at the Proms.
Actually, 21.
Have you?
Yeah.
21?
It was my 21st birthday, as it were.
Oh, great. Well, it started in 1990, didn't it, your first ever Proms?
My first Prom was the Janáček in 1990 with Sir Charles McCarrish. And actually, it was quite funny because it really wasn't known, and I barely knew it. It had sort of been discovered in a drawer somewhere or something like that. And, of course, what happened was he started to write this violin concerto and it wasn't going very well. But so it's only 15 minutes long, and then he took the material and wrote From the House of the Dead.
Right.
But this sort of fragment of this violin concerto, suddenly everybody decided it was a really important thing that it should be played and all of this lot. So I was asked to play it by John Drummond when he was the controller of the Proms. And I went to Cardiff to rehearse it with the Welsh National Opera Orchestra and Charlie McCarris. And I was rehearsing with my back to the orchestra. And, of course, I'd never heard it before.
Yeah.
And I started to play because it begins with a violin solo. And then I thought the roof was falling in because this extraordinary noise was happening. And then, of course, I realised it was the chains that Janáček loves, these sort of clanking chains. So I turned around and there's this dutiful percussionist jangling these extremely noisy chains.
Not his terms of employment.
That's right.
But do you know, I've often thought, because you know, when I play piano things, that it's quite good playing things that nobody knows. When I did my degree finals, I played Schoenberg's Suite Opus 26, Opus 25. Nobody cared. You can make whatever mistakes you want. Did Charles McCarris know it? Because he was a bit of a Janáček specialist, wasn't he?
Exactly. Well, he didn't know it in a way any better than I did, in the sense that neither of us had performed it before. But of course, he had the benefit of the full score, which
right.
I didn't.
Right.
So he was able to see that these clanking chains were supposed to happen, whereas I had no idea. Clanking chains. That's the one. And you're absolutely right about the fact that it was really good to make my debut playing something that nobody knew, because it took the pressure off. I mean, you know, making your debut in the Royal Albert Hall for the Proms, you know, with live broadcast and everything is a huge thing. And particularly the nature of the hall is so different from many concert halls. And you're just aware that you're enveloped by the audience, which is a great thing. And it's actually one of the marvellous things about the Proms. But when you sort of look at that audience in its entirety for the very first time, having seen a cavernous empty space beforehand, that is quite something. So it's guaranteed to induce a few butterflies. And, you know, the fact that I knew the piece better than pretty much anybody other than Charlie McGarris. So that was reassuring. I'm always grateful that I was asked to do that and not Mozart, because Mozart's terrifying.
Yeah.
Mozart's even more terrifying in a very large acoustic, which is what the Albert Hall is.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, actually, what you walk out into that big space, you've got your violin, what are the particular issues? I've never played the violin what are the particular, with that huge, vast expanse of plush furniture?
Yeah, the main issue is one of clarity. Are you playing for the audience in the hall, or are you playing for the microphones of the live broadcast to a great deal more people? Because when you play in an acoustic that's very generous, you can lose bits of words. So it's a bit like so you only get part of the sentence, is what I'm saying. And so there are steps that you can take to help that and alleviate it. But in doing so, the playing would probably come out as a little bit stilted over a microphone and through airwaves, where there's the benefit of the engineer sorting the sound out.
Yeah.
So there has to be something of a compromise that you've got to allow perhaps a little more space and have a bit more clarity, but not so much that the audience listening at home are wondering why you're playing in a rather odd way.
Yeah. Interesting that, isn't it? The, you know, there are 5,000 something people in there, which seems it's a vast crowd.
Yeah.
But out there in the big wide world, that is just a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
So that's a bit spooky. Do you ever kind of have that feeling when you're doing something, when you've been playing those live broadcasts, because you could get overwhelmed by that audience?
Particularly the last night of the Proms, which I think they say something like 100 million worldwide audience.
Mm.
I don't even know how many zeros that is.
Yeah.
But that is certainly an amount that feels fairly extraordinary, and certainly daunting if you start to think about it. It's an interesting thing how one plays for a broadcast, and psychologically there is a difference in your mind. I always liked to know when I was doing something for the BBC, is this live or is this a deferred relay? And in the later years, many of them were deferred relays, except, of course, the Proms is always live. And so you've got to psych yourself up to it in a very, very specific way. And backstage at the Albert Hall, it's like you're in the bowels of the earth. Mm. You just go down and down and down more staircases. And it is... the dressing rooms used to be very cramped. So early on, you almost had to be careful where you put your bow because you might, you know, hit the wall or the ceiling or something like that. And they were either incredibly hot or far too cold, neither of which is ideal. If you're too hot as a violinist, you slide around the fingerboard and the chin rest becomes a little bit sweaty. and it's just difficult, bearing in mind the fact that you've got a priceless instrument that your neck and your chin are keeping safe. That can result in you tensing up, worrying about dropping the violin because of the fact that there's not enough friction there to keep the violin where it needs to be. Yeah. But if you're too cold, you can get sort of clammy hands and fingers that just don't want to move. And actually, I've got a funny story for you with the last night of the proms, which I did twice. In 1995, I did it in the hall, but in 1998, I did it in the park for 40,000 people, which is the largest audience I've ever looked at, and it was quite something. But the night before the live event, so the Friday night, we had a rehearsal, which was just as well. You know, rehearsals are always a really good idea, Raina. So what happened was that the BBC very kindly, because by this time it was September, so nighttime temperatures were around about 8 degrees, which is, you know, cold enough when you've got to play with precision. But the BBC very, very kindly laid on these beautiful heated caravan dressing rooms. Right. So you were kept nicely warm until that moment when you had to, you know, jump on stage in a long frock with the violin and everything. But what happened in the rehearsal was that I and my violin had been wonderfully warm, got on stage, and my fingers were freezing, but my violin suddenly reacted as often wood reacts when it goes from warmth to cold very quickly. Everything shrinks. My pegs shrank and my strings unraveled. And basically there was no string to play on.
Yeah.
Which, bearing in mind it was a solo violin piece, was definitely a problem.
Yeah.
So I was doing a version of Paganini's famous 24th Caprice. You know, dum ba da da dum ba da da dum ba da da lee dum.
Is this Paganiniana?
Yes, yeah. It was Paganiniana by Milstein. Well, at points. The end of that round, you have scored 10 out of 10 and no passes, Raina.
I did win a celebrity counterpoint, as I recall.
Well done.
Yeah, that was, right, yeah. So Pegs, you're on stage.
I'm on stage.
You're playing a solo violin, but and your Pegs, violin hasn't got any strings.
And I haven't got any strings to play on. Mm. So I retuned my violin and the same thing happened again.
Oh.
Which was making me very nervous because I was going to be the only person on stage at that moment in time, and 100 million people were going to be listening to my Pegs not in tune.
This is a rehearsal, you're not actually.
This
doing
is the night before.
Right.
And I was thinking, what is going wrong? And then it clicked. My violin doesn't like the sudden drop in temperature. Mm. So the next night, I left my violin case outside, acclimatizing to the cold.
Got knit.
it was under luckily lots of nice security people keeping all the high-tech equipment there very safe, as well as anybody else's instruments. So the violin was banished outside to the cold, and I was kept nice and warm inside with my hair and curlers in the warmth of my dressing room. And then, and it worked perfectly. So to anybody who's actually listening to this who might be playing the violin and might be doing an outdoorsy gig, for goodness sake, don't leave your instrument inside a nice warm dressing room only to then have a problem with it later.
That, by the way, also you casually, you know, gloss over the did, but that is much more than that. It's a virtuoso showcase.
Well, to be honest, that piece is really difficult. And we did a cut down version because the BBC wanted 3 minutes. So I did the main variations.
Right.
But by 30 seconds in, I actually couldn't feel my fingers because they were so cold. And it is the oddest experience to play with numb fingers. Ah. And I, luckily, you know, with all those years and years and years of practice, you've got muscle memory as to the distance that you've got to jump in order to leap to some of these difficult places on the fingerboard, but it was one of the hardest things I ever did to play and not feel my finger.
It is nerve-wracking being a performer. Can you walk out, especially as a violinist, forgive me this, and I mean probe this, you walk out holding a violin and there is an orchestra of whom about 35 also play the violin.
Yes.
What, I mean, and of those, about 33 of them think they could probably, you know, they did this at college and they can play it better than you. What is that kind of psychology like, that thing, dealing with people playing your instruments, which as a pianist you don't get. People do play the, but you're not actually on stage with other pianists.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's a very, it's an interesting one. And particularly as there are more violins in an orchestra than any other instrument, because you're going to have the first and second violins. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of them looking at you, sometimes having to look at your back. But that's just as bad in a way, because they're seeing your elbow technique from a very interesting angle. And, you know, with the left hand, well, no, with the right hand as well, with the bow arm, both, you know, elbows are actually an important part of the equation. I know it sounds a little odd to say that, but it's all about positioning. And yes, do you know what? Actually, I think I've been very fortunate in that many, you know, when I was very young, people were sort of intrigued by whether I was going to be any good. And then it gets worse once you start to make a name for yourself, because then there are layers of expectation there that you have to hopefully fulfil, because you want to for yourself, but you want to for your colleagues as well. So that's the moment when it gets worse. But that's also the moment where I think perhaps most players wouldn't think that they could do it better than you.
Mm.
Nevertheless, they still want to know that you can still do it. I think there was only one orchestra, which was the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, where I was, actually perhaps the Berlin Phil, but the New York Phil, I was playing the Tchaikovsky Concerto with them, and I was very aware that every single player on stage would be able to do a pretty passable job. And some of them did not only look at me with narrowed eyes, but practice really loudly outside my dressing room.
Really?
The Tchaikovsky.
Really?
Just to, you know, show me that I was on stage with people that knew how to do it. I've rarely encountered that with another orchestra where lots of players congregate outside and play the piece that you're about to play.
They are famously a bunch of bastards, aren't they?
Oh, I didn't say that.
They are.
But no, and actually, in fact, lots of them did come up to me afterwards and were very nice. But just to begin with, I think there was a little bit of a, shall we see if we can psych her out kind of thing.
How interesting. Well, I have to say, one time at the Festival Hall, I, with another violinist whose name I won't mention, Nicola Bertinetti. She was my comedy bitch one time. We missed being my comedy bitch one time because you knackered your finger.
Sorry.
But that will live forever in our memory as a glorious opportunity that we didn't actually realise. But the thing I did well, it was with the Philharmonic Orchestra, and I said, you know, we actually, in this opportunity, it's a strange concert, so we actually asked the violins, would you instead like to play a violin concerto? And they all said to a man and woman, we'd like to play the Mendelssohn. So, okay, we're going to give the viola, the violins of the Philharmonic Orchestra a chance, their big moment, to actually do, to compete with the solos. Unfortunately, if they all play the solo line, there's nobody to play the tutti, so Nicola, would you mind? She put an old grubby cardigan on her and she went dubba 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 dubba. And then they all stood up going da 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 da. Let me just tell you now, Tasmin, that 30 something people playing that high is effing intolerable.
Yes.
It is like, I couldn't believe how awful
it
was.
Anyway, and actually, you know what? Everybody thinks that that piece is so easy and beautiful and lyrical. Well, the last one, yes. The first two, well, no, the middle one, yes, but easy, no. And that opening is one of the hardest. In fact, do you know that Isaac Stern said that it was the Mendelssohn that he remained most scared of to his last concert?
Interesting. Because you think, you know, there is actually, in this video, you've probably seen it, they did a couple of videos. One was The Great Conductors, and they, you know, dug up video and footage of whatever The Great Conductors. And then they followed that up with The Great Violinists. And there was about, I don't know, 12 or 15 or something great violinists, Nathan Milstein and Heifetz and all the other people. And they started that DVD by cutting together people playing the Mendelssohn. So, you know, da 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 dee dee da dee ba da da dee da 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 da. It was all from different shots. And so that is surely the violin concerto that pretty much everybody goes through in order to get to the other violin concertos. So the fact he thought it was, you know, they had that effect on him.
Oh, it is. It's not to be taken lightly, that one. It is extremely difficult. And the last movement is an absolute swine. It is so, because it's got to be dancing and delicate. It's got to sound effortless.
Yeah.
And yet the way that, what you've got to do to make these sounds requires huge effort and dexterity.
Yeah. No, I'm just casting my doubt. You never played the Mendelssohn at the Proms, did you? You played so many other things.
Yeah, no, I never did
the Mendelssohn.
I mean, you
played the Delius, which that's got to be a hard one.
I played the Delius concerto, I played the Delius double concerto, I played the Britten double concerto.
You played the Dvorak as well, and that is a famous note twiddler, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the Lark Ascending various times, including at the last night of the Proms. Elgar a few times, actually.
Yeah.
I did all sorts of things, and then Glazunov, and then some contemporary works
Ligeti.
As well. I did do the Ligeti, and I also gave the world premiere of the Stuart McRae violin concerto. I can't remember all the other things that I did. But yep, I did Sibelius, of course.
Yeah.
I did quite a wide range of repertoire, which was brilliant. And I didn't mind playing some of the weird stuff, because I think one of the things I love about the Proms is that the audience is so open-minded. They will give everything a fair shot, and everybody. That's not to say that they are unanimously positive if somebody's not doing their stuff properly. I have heard them be less than warm at the end of a performance when it hasn't really gone very well.
Can you name any names?
No.
You did also do, and I'm quoting from my reading about this, 2012, Wallace and Gromit Prom gave the performance of a concerto in, which is described as being an E-lad. it was 5 minutes and I read it, and then it said, a composer unknown, to which I assume nobody wanted to put their name to.
Actually, upstairs, at the top of the stairs, I've got the poster of that prom.
Great.
And signed by the man himself. And it was one of those proms that was great fun to do. It was right up your street, really, Raina, with lots of fun and games.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it, but I had to record the second violin part, which was supposed to be played by Gromit. And then I played, it was a double concerto, so I played with myself on the stage of the Royal Albert Hall, if that doesn't sound too odd.
No.
and it was remarkably difficult to do, because whilst one thinks of oneself as, you know, able to follow a beat, I did actually have to rehearse a lot with the track that was recorded by me. And, you know, my instinct as a performer is always to do something a little different. And I had to really squelch that one.
Did you not have a click track or something?
I didn't have a click track, but I had been given the recorded track to rehearse with, which is the equivalent, really.
So for them thinking, what the hell's a click track? Let me just backtrack over that. So a click track is essentially a recording of the beat which musicians play to.
It's the most boring thing on earth.
It is. It irons out the kind of spontaneity of it. But it's used a lot in film music, where things in the music have to match what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, it's got to be timed to perfection.
Absolutely. So, you know, you want, you know, da 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 bum bum, you know, whatever it is, the things to happen with the exciting James Bondy type moment. You would a second ahead. And so the music doesn't move at regular pace. It changes in pace, and that pace is indicated by the beat. And so the musicians can fit the things together. They're all listening in a thing you can't hear, to a click track. And that's the sort of thing, when you have to do what Tasman has just described, that you might expect, a click track that you'd be listening to, which enable you to recapture and play along exactly with what you'd already recorded. But yeah, that's not very prompty, is it?
No. It's very awkward. Actually, I have a story about a click track, because when Dominic Muldowney wrote a violin concerto, which I premiered, it was for two orchestras and only one soloist, but two conductors, and the orchestras were playing with different tempos. And so each conductor had a click track. So each conductor was listening via headphones to the click track, and I had to practice to my click track so that I could move seamlessly and effortlessly between one tempo and another tempo. It was a bit of an experiment. I'm not sure it quite worked, but it was a very intriguing thing to do, and it was good, very good discipline for me to learn how to play with that. Well, with that rigidity, which, as I say, goes slightly against the grain of spontaneous musicianship.
Yeah, I have occasionally practiced in the times when I played the piano and had to practice with the recordings, and it's just lifeless. What you produce at the end is, it's hard to describe why that might be the case, but it is, and that's all there is to it.
I think the thing is that playing music is like breathing, and it's like us talking with our own distinctive style, and there'll be the way that I phrase my sentences, where I breathe. It's very individual, and the way that we play is equally individual. And I think that's why this is one of the secret ingredients that an audience will lock into or not. So there'll be people that really like my playing because they really like the way I'm expressing the music. There'll be other people who, you know, really couldn't give a monkey's about my playing because it just somehow or other doesn't speak to them. And you can't take offence at something like that. It's somebody's individuality. You just can't take it personally.
No, well, I've just had a conversation about how one can possibly tell one orchestra apart from another, and this touches on that sort of area. Why, you know, it's this classic thing one comes back to, you know, what can be possibly different about two performances of classical music? It's all written down, it's all set in stone. Well, it isn't, basically. It's the equivalent of, you know, I was saying, to be or not to be, that is the question. So, ought to be.
Or not to be.
Is the to be or not to be, that is the question. To be or not to be, that is the question. There are tons of ways, and all of them equally valid. And music is like that.
About that quote, you know that there's a YouTube video of all sorts of fantastic actors saying that and coming on. And I think even Prince Charles comes on at the end and says it in a different way. And they all are supposed to say it in a completely different way. But it does, it beautifully exhibits exactly that point, that everybody has got such an individuality, whether they like it or not, and whether they're trying or not.
Yeah, whereas, to use the click track analogy, if it was to be or not to be, that if you had to do that, all of a sudden, spontaneity you might bring out, reacting to the situation, the hall, your own personal emotions, that all goes, and you're just left repeating something
exactly,
kind of by rote a little bit.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Yeah.
So one of the things you also done in 2008 was Ethel Smythe's Concerto for Violin and Horn. This year is Ethel Smythe year.
I know, and actually one of the proms that I'm really looking forward to is the Wreckers, because I have never heard it. And everybody says it's fantastic. And when is it? I can't remember when that one is.
Very early on. And actually, that's one of my top tips as well.
Sunday, 24th of July.
Yeah.
And it's lovely, Robin Ticciotti, who I adore.
He speaks the music to me.
Anyway, he is a wonderful person. He's just a complete delight. And I can't wait to hear this Smythe.
No, I think that's really exciting. Do you know, they did it once in 1994. Odeline de la Martinez, do you ever come across her?
Do you know? She's an absolutely crazy but marvellous woman. And I love her to pieces. Yeah. She's really batty, but that she's always interesting. Yeah.
She did it in 1994. So this what's nice about this, because it's coming from Glyndebourne, it's a production they've really worked on.
Yeah.
Everything will be thought through. It'll be semi-staged. Yeah. It'll have a reel. This is going to be Ethel Smythe's moment. The best time, the way it's been.
Absolutely.
As she would have dreamed of it being done, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. And also I see that they are doing the Concerto for Violin and Horn.
Absolutely.
Which won't have been done since I did it, whenever it was that I did it.
I can tell you when you did that. Let me just refer back to my very detailed, copious notes here. I'm groping now. Ethel Smythe, 2008 is when you did it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So who was your hornist?
It was Richard Watkins.
Oh, okay.
And he was absolutely fantastic and really, really loved doing it. The problem is that piece does come, you know, we were talking earlier about what are the problems in the hall and acoustically that, you know, it's not very clear. And in a piece like that, where the horn is going to reverberate for a long time and is a more powerful instrument anyway than the violin, that does bring certain balance issues that obviously the engineers and the, you know, in the control room are going to sort out for your radio audience. But it's not. I'm not. My empathy is with lovely Elena Urioste, who's going to be the violinist, because she's got her work cut out, making herself audible in that piece. No matter how clever the horn player is, it just is problematic in certain places.
It's not an obvious match, is it?
No, and there's a very good reason why it's not done very often.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, can I be absolutely honest about that piece? Because I've heard a recording, and actually, you know, probably on YouTube or something, and it did sound a little bit like a violin concerto with the horn playing a bit too loud in the orchestra.
Yeah.
I have an open mind. It's a very interesting thing, but, you know, it attracts my interest because, okay, this I've got to really listen to because I want to see if they can do this. Can I be convinced about this?
Well, that's it. And I think that, first of all, I mean, it's great that she is finally having her moment and it's long overdue. But there's such a nice mix of all sorts of things that even if, for instance, you don't like the Wreckers or the Concerto for Violin and Horn, there's a trio that's being done, there's all sorts of bits and pieces of hers, so at least we can get an overview of different styles of pieces. And that's another thing that the Proms does really well, that, you know, when they decide they're going to feature somebody, they give everybody a good taste of what that composer might be about.
Yeah, that, by the way, is the Concerto for Violin and Horn. It is Monday the 25th of July. I mean, also on that programme is Ruslan and Ludmila, which is a very famous overture, and Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, which is, you know, a very famous symphony, if you like your symphonies and like your bit Rachmaninoff. So in that programme, there's a bit of There's a bit of everything. And that's the amazing thing, actually, about the Proms, isn't it? Because there are all these, there is this match-up of stuff, which if you were a kind of commercial promoter, it's Tasman and Rayner's orchestral series. We're sitting here planning it. I mean, you would kind of want a bit more, each programme to somehow a little bit, have a bit more coherence somehow. But with the Proms, you have to kind of zoom out and go, it's over the whole thing.
I think that's exactly right. The Proms, if you're going to, you know, really listen to lots of concerts, you'll have got a most incredible musical banquet by the end of it. And of course, you can dip in and out and pick and choose. But I do think that, yes, I mean, there are loose connections going on with the Proms, but it's a festival, it's a party, it's a, you know, it's a gathering of people who just want to share music, whether they know it or not.
The other thing you've done The Last Night twice. So, oh, you mentioned once was Proms in the Park, which
right.
is, in a way, it's in a way bigger.
Yeah.
When people think of The Last Night, the Proms, of course, the 100 million people, whatever it is, it is the flag waving, it's all that jazz.
Yeah.
You did The Lark Ascending?
I did The Lark Ascending and Saint-Saëns Introduction and Rondo Capriccioso. Ooh. And lovely Andrew Davis was my conductor on that occasion. And, I mean, he just is exactly the perfect person for that role because on that particular night, as we know, the conductor's not just the conductor lead, you know, in charge of the orchestra and everything. They've got this speech that they've got to make.
Yeah.
So there's quite a lot of pressure and they've got to bring the audience on board. They've got to not cheese everybody off. They've got to conduct them in the, you know, the hornpipe and everything and somehow or other forge a relationship with 6,000 people in a very short space of time. So I think that that particular event for a conductor must be one of the enjoyable ones, but also slightly nerve-wracking because a lot of conductors are judged on that.
Mm. And what's it like? What way does it differ from the ordinary Proms, the inverted commas, ordinary Proms?
Yeah, I think it's just much more of a party atmosphere. Everyone's letting their hair down. And the promenaders are in total party mood. They're allowed to make noise. And I mean, I love the way that they already do have their certain things, like the moving of the piano. They've got their heave-ho and all of that lot. And for The Last Night, it's their moment, really, the promenaders. And they collect for charities every year. And, you know, so that's their moment to say how much they've raised for charity. They give the soloists a gift, which is really lovely. I got a bottle of champagne when I did my Last Night. So there's a lot that focuses on the promenaders being allowed to really audibly join in the action, you know, and the way they all bend their knees with the hornpipe and you know, go jump, jump, da 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 jump, jump, you know, and lots of things. And of course, everybody sings at the end. So it's quite a unifying event from that point of view. And now, of course, the whole Proms in not just one park, but many parks, has become a larger and larger focus of the evening. And I think that that's good because I think it draws together all strands of the British Isles, as it were. And I think it stops it from being too London-centric, which I think nowadays is really important.
What do you think of that? I hear all that. What do you think of The Last Night of the Proms generally? Do you think it should be maybe revamped and some other songs, as they say, be sung instead or something?
I'm not greatly in favour of that, to be honest, because I think it was tried once and a lot of people were very, very annoyed about it. Mm. And, I know that you can look at some of this repertoire and say, oh, it's tired or perhaps it's not politically correct anymore or whatever. But at the end of the day, I think there's a tradition there that happens only once a year. We're not too flag-waving on too many other occasions. So I don't think there's any harm in it, to be honest. And there are plenty of aspects elsewhere in that particular programme that change every year, namely what the soloists play or sing. So it's only really the last little bit of it that amounts to a very small proportion of that whole concert.
Yeah, it's actually only the last 20 minutes of the second half,
exactly.
Really. I mean, even in the beginning of the second half, it's something else. Okay, let's, if you don't mind, indulge me. Let's just go through the violin concertos. Now, I am not... I'm a very bad viola player, so I recognise some of these names, and I'm going to mispronounce them, so you can correct me on the pronunciation. But I have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 violin concertos, unless I've miscounted. Ethel Smythe we talked about.
Yeah, and it's actually Smythe, by the way. You're supposed to say...
Oh, is it?
Yeah, apparently.
Smythe.
Yep, I'm afraid so. I don't like it either. I think it sounds a bit odd, but
Ethel
apparently...
Smythe.
Ethel Smythe.
Well, she was quite a bossy.
Jolly autistic.
She was, I should
very
say
bossy.
So, rather.
Yes,
well, there
was.
We go. Like Purcell. Maybe they'll go back to Smythe. That sounds like Purcell and Purcell and all the other things.
Well, I always think Purcell sounds like a washing powder.
It does, doesn't it? And it is. Proms 15 is the Barber Violin Concerto.
Yes.
I love that concerto.
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. Of course, you know the story, which was that it was commissioned by a very rich man for his protégé, but the protégé wasn't actually apparently very good, so he said to Barber, please don't make it too difficult. So Barber wrote the first two movements.
And the last one goes mental.
Don't jump the gun. I'm telling the story, Rainer.
Sorry.
So he wrote the first two. Yeah, no, stop interrupting that, please, dear. Thank you. So he wrote the first two movements. And, of course, there's this nice long oboe solo at the beginning of the second movement. And all the good bits are given to everybody else other than the violin. Anyway, and he sounds a little bit spoilt, this protégé. He insisted on... looking at the first two movements before the last one had been written. So Barber went along and showed it to him, and the protégé went, oh, this is far too easy. So Barber thought, right, and he made the last movement stinkingly difficult, and then the protégé looked at it and went, oh, this is far too difficult. Actually, maybe he was American. Oh, this is far too difficult. So, and I think I'm sure he would have been American. Anyway, Barber said, well, I've written it now, and the very rich man said he wanted his commission money back. And Barber said, I'm terribly sorry, I've spent it. So anyway, there we go. So that's the story of the Barber Violin Concerto. And I do think that the middle movement is the best bit of it. I like the middle bit of the first movement, but I do think that the piece is not... I think it could have been better. I think had he written it for somebody that could really, really play the violin, he would have done it differently. I think he was a little bit shackled by... you know, by what he thought he was supposed to be doing.
It's very lyrical. I mean, it's beautifully lyrical, but it's a little bit unbalanced. The last movement reminds me of the last movement of Chopin's Second Piano Sonata, which is it's this strange thing that Chopin sometimes did. It doesn't add up. Where does that come from?
Exactly. It doesn't balance, and that's the thing. I'm not saying that it's not a good violin concerto. I just don't think it's a great violin concerto.
Well, that's been played by Johan Dillin.
Oh, yes. He's very young, 20 years old, and he won, I think he won the Yuri Menuhin International Violin Competition, and he's done very well. And he's hot stuff. I think it's going to be worth listening to.
You have been on the jury of
twice,
things.
Yes, of the Menuhin competition, once in Beijing in 2012, and when it was in London in 2016, which, of course, was the centenary of Yehudi's birth.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, okay. And then Missy Mazzini's, who's a new person. That's POM 38.
I have that one down on my list of I want to really, really make sure I hear. It's Sunday, 14th of August.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to have to play that one back on iPlayer because that's my son's birthday.
Okay.
So I'm afraid we will not be going to the prom. We will be going out for a very nice meal.
Yeah.
But I will definitely be catching up with that one. And there's also wonderful Prokofiev of Romeo and Juliet in the second half. And I love, the whole thing, but you know, we've got an entire second half of
more than
amazing music.
Yeah, more than the dance of the Capulets and the what's it?
Yes, it will be.
And then Augustin Haderlich is playing Dvorak.
Oh, now listen, he is, I think, one of the greatest violinists on stage at the moment. He is an incredible performer. I am not going to be missing this.
Yeah.
I love his playing. He is a thoughtful musician, but his technique is it's just bulletproof. It's incredible.
And you kind of need that. Listen, from the casual, I don't play the violin standpoint, that Dvorak, it's a lot of notes, isn't it?
It's a lot of notes, and it's a curious shape. It's a very similar shape, funnily enough, to the Max Bruch No. 1. Shortish first movement, long lyrical slow movement, and then fun and games in the last movement. So it all really happens in the slow movement and the last movement. The last movement is very awkwardly written. I wonder whether this is one reason why it's not done so often. Like the Glazunov, It's great when it's done well, and it's terrible when it is not done marvellously.
Yeah, do you know what? I've been through various phases of not being a violinist, of rooting around in the violin concerto repertoire, and that was one I kind of didn't know till relatively recently.
Do you want to know a fun fact?
Tell me.
Do you see that clock there?
It's made out of a score of Dvorak violin concerto.
Not quite.
Yeah.
But it's a long-playing record, yeah. But in the middle bit of it, it is a CD, as you can see. And that is my very first recording that I made, which is of the Bruch No. 1 and the Dvorak concerto. It was the first thing I recorded.
How extraordinary.
There we go. So you're looking at it, Rainer.
You played it also with the Scottish... BBC Scottish Orchestra and Jerzy Maksymiuk in 1990. Well, so you've got your fingers around that. Well, anyway, that's an exciting thing that we're looking forward to. Great. Then I've got numbers. Brahms concerto with Daniel Lozakovich.
Yep. Now I don't know him. I do know the Brahms, but I'm going to be really interested in him. It's not a name that I'm familiar with, but that's the nice thing about the Proms, isn't it? That, you know, very often the Proms will showcase young up-and-coming, so like Johan Dahlén, young up-and-coming talent and give them a real serious platform. And it's really how I started my career in 1990. It's not that I hadn't done any concerts till then, but it was just that the exposure of playing at the Proms plus releasing that recording that you can look at on the wall. That was really what did it. That gave me, you know, a serious foot up several rungs of the ladder.
Well, okay, that's great. Can I tell you honestly, of the great violin concertos, my least favourite is the Brahms. Can't tell you why.
You have to go and listen to my recording.
Oh, okay, there we go.
or listen to David Oistrakh.
Okay.
Because he's the violinist's violinist.
Yeah.
His sound would just melt any heart.
Yeah.
And he was just such a great musician. Ah. So forget listening to me. Don't worry about me. Go and listen to David Oistrakh. No, listen to David Oistrakh.
Shall I tell you a story about that? I once did an interview with Yehudi for a Radio 3 series.
Right.
And we went to that place that he is in Chester...
Square.
It was a series called Rainer Hirsch's 20th Century Retrospective, rather self-effacing. It was for Radio 3, six programmes. And one of the programmes was about the greatest, looking back on the whole century, the greatest musicians, which is absurd, I know, but we sold the series, that's what the programme was called, and I had to make it about that. And we spoke to Yehudi, and I put him on the list of people that I'd like to speak to, and to my amazement, he said yes. And we were shown up to his Paganini room, which had all this Paganini memorabilia in it, and these photos, incredible photos, of Yehudi with, Rostropovich, Yehudi with Nehru, Yehudi with God, looking a bit sheepish, and pleased to meet Yehudi. Anyway, we're looking around this stuff thinking we could nick some of this if nobody had taken care of, you know, who we were. We turned around and he was like Nosferatu. He suddenly appeared, like, boosh, there he was.
Wow.
And I asked him who was the greatest violinist and he said Oistrakh. Mm. And he said it's very hard to say and I'm sorry I have to push all this point because that's what our show's called.
Yeah.
I also wanted to tell that story, which he was famous story he used to say, about rehearsing with Toscanini in New York. He's rehearsing, this is, you know, after he's a child prodigy and everything in the early 30s, and he's doing the Beethoven concerto with Oistrakh.
Yeah.
And they're in some hotel room, and Toscanini is playing the piano, and Yehudi's playing the violin, and the telephone goes, and it's one of those big boxes on the wall.
Oh, brilliant.
And Toscanini ignored it, and they carried on playing. It went again, ignored it. The third time Toscanini went over to this box, wrenched it off the wall, threw it down, then went back to the piano and carried on playing like nothing had happened. And this was Toscanini, this was Yehudi's story about the concentration. And I wanted Yehudi to tell that story, and I wanted to say, I wrote a little script for him saying, I wanted to ask him, who was it on the phone? And I wanted him to say...
Yes, I want to know.
It was the technician saying they got the line working again. That was my joke. But by this time, he was right at the end of his life and he wasn't in the mood to do my little bit of comedy. But anyway, he said Oistrakh too. So there we go. That's something.
He was a great raconteur, you know.
There we go.
I don't know whether we might have to cut this bit out, but he did tell me the most marvellous story when we were together in Poland, in Warsaw, and we were having dinner. And he told me this hilarious story about going to visit Bartok at his apartment. And I don't know, Bartok went out, I think, because Bartok wrote his solo violin sonata for Yehudi. So anyway, I don't know whether Bartok went to get some more pencil and paper or something like that. Anyway, of course, there's the usual photos in frames and stuff like that, and Yehudi was just casually looking through them, and right up at the back there's this picture of Bartok and his wife rock climbing entirely naked. So there we go. So he also told a hilarious story about Walton, about going to visit Lady Walton, Susanna and William Walton, and that Walton was going to write him a violin sonata. And Yehudi and Diana were staying with the Waltons. Diana, his very scary wife at times. But anyway, she was actually quite a darling underneath it all. Anyway, so the four of them decided they were going to walk into the centre of Ischia and go and grab some more manuscript paper and at the music shop, etc.
This has been the island where William Walton lived. This is off the Naples coast.
Exactly. Basically. Stunning, stunning area. And I've been to the house, which has got beautiful gardens and everything. And
they still exhibit the gardens, don't they?
Yes, 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 they do. And Susanna was an absolutely superb character. She's absolutely brilliant. Oh, darling, darling, and she talked like that. So anyway, so they were walking down the hill and, of course, famously, Walton was rather cross that Benjamin Britten was, you know, really courted and feted by everybody. So he was a bit jealous of Benjamin Britten. And Yehudi realised to his increasing horror as they got closer to the music shop, there was this great huge, in the window, this great display of things of Benjamin Britten, including music and, you know, and photographs and this, that and the other, which sounds sort of interesting, bearing in mind the fact it was where Walton lived. But anyway, apparently that was what happened. And it was all against the backdrop of a sort of velveteen curtain. Anyway, Walton apparently pretended to take no notice whatsoever and said that he was going to go inside to buy the paper. And Yehudi was looking at this display while they were waiting outside, and then he saw this hand slowly emerging through the curtain and taking the picture of Benjamin Britten and very gently placing it face down, and then the hand retreated, and then Walton came out apparently as if nothing had happened whatsoever. But the way that Yehudi told that story was incredibly funny, and I will never forget it.
My comedy version is it replaced with a picture of William Walton. So, obviously, we've got another one, exciting one, Winter Marsalis with Nicola Benedetti.
Yeah,
that's going to be jazzy. That's going to be all those kind of things you'd expect from him. And it's quite a long one. It's 45 minutes.
Yes.
So, needless to say, you know, something that lasts that long and is going to be what we expected for it. It's going to be a showpiece.
It's bound to be a showpiece. I can't wait to hear it. And when you're working with a composer, you want to do your best with the composer's material. You want to hopefully inspire them, but they want to write a piece specifically with you in mind. So I've had various things written for me, and you know, I've enjoyed that process of collaboration hugely, and there's a great respect that goes alongside it, and it's a bit like giving birth, you know, and you realise that there's this moment the night before that you'd better not die, because you're the only person that can play the piece at that moment in time.
Right.
So anyway, I'm saying that Nicola would be worrying about that, but there is this moment where you are still the only person on earth who is playing that piece of music, and you feel such a huge responsibility towards the composer, you know, to really make something of this piece that they've poured their heart and soul into, to really make it work for the audience. And it's a very exciting process. So, yeah, that one's huge on my list.
Yeah. And the final one is I've got Prom 71, whenever that is. And that is Camille Saint-Saëns Introduction Rondo, which you said you already played at the last night. Did you say that?
I did, yes.
And Lisa Batiashvili,
yes. She is another wonderful player,
yeah.
A very experienced player.
Listen, you've done the proms so many times. I mean, that's an amazing achievement. And, you know, people love you and loved you doing it. You once said that someone wouldn't be the same without... if I'm not playing the proms, you know, when you were doing it. And now you've stopped. And, you know, for reasons, you know, you explained to me, you know, you've been playing the violin since you can ever remember.
Mm.
And now there are new directions you want to go. But, you know, when you see these kind of pieces come out, they're like, you know, I did that.
Yeah.
Is there, and with these people, I met him, I'd met her, I did that.
Yeah.
She wrote a piece for me. Mm. Do you ever feel kind of this pang of, oh, I wish I was still doing that again?
Not really, Raina, because I'm still so involved in music in different ways. And I love sitting back and hearing good people play brilliantly. And I don't have to do a thing. It's marvellous. And if I ever miss anything, I have got all this music in my head. I can play any piece I ever want to, whenever I want. So it's all still there. If I really miss myself, I can always put on a recording. I made 45 of them. So if I ever feel that I need to, you know, recapture a little bit of fun and stuff, I can do that if I want to. But one nice thing, actually, my mother said to me this morning, now, when is your prom or when are your proms? Because I'm actually going to be the interval feature. I'm going to chat in the box twice. And it gave me quite a turn when she said it because I thought, no, I don't do that anymore. So that was another very funny moment. But I'll be chatting on the 18th of July live in the interval and on the 4th of September for Fab. those. So it's nice to still be involved in the proms live.
Yeah, so that's on BBC TV for them.
And then no, it'll be on Radio 3.
Oh, okay, well, there we go. Even better. So you remain queen of the proms and you're definitely queen of our hearts. And thank you so much. I mean, how interesting was all that? It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thanks, Raina. It's always great fun to talk to you too.
Well, that was Tasmin. What an exciting thing to meet her. She's an absolute legend and an extremely nice person, as you'll guess from that chat. The things I remember, especially walking up the gangplank and, you know, having the audience gradually appear from the gallery to the arena, which is the very bottom of the viewing audience. And that, you know, you don't have time to kind of ready yourself and do it when the moment strikes, which you do when you perform elsewhere. You're pushed on and that's that. And of course, I can't help but laugh at the idea of performing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto and people in the orchestra who can also play the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto hovering around your dressing room, psyching you out by playing it in the background. Now, I mentioned the occasional musical treat. This edition of Proms in the Pub goes out just days before the first night of the Proms 2022 on the 15th of July, which is entirely devoted to the Verdi Requiem, all 84 minutes of it, according to the Proms programme. Now, I think the Verdi Requiem is sort of known and unknown at the same time. Strike me down, but I think it's got one really famous tune, which is the Dies Irae. And, well, I can tell you a story about how I think that's known and unknown another time. But in order to sort of balance that out, I've asked a very good friend of mine, Harry the Piano, an amazing pianist, harrythepiano.com, if you want to look him up, to remind us of some of Verdi's better-known tunes. Here he is with a Verdi medley. See how many you can pick out. Until next time, thanks for listening. Please subscribe. Take it away, Harry.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.